This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pograin Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Demons Make Good.
The Number of the Beast.
The Sasa Bonsam.
And Jacques Collin de Plancy.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of 8-sided dice. The crunch of extra fire-hot nacho Doritos. The thump of miniature demons.
And the benevolent countenance of Peter Frampton coming alive. Welcome us once more into a satanic, demonic, devilish edition of The Gaming Hut. And Robin, to save my metal announcer voice, you have a premise for The Gaming Hut.
Right.
A choose your own damnation episode, because this is, for those who have not paid attention, episode 666.
Yes. So it has been pointed out to us that we would have to do an all demons and devils special for 666. So let's start that off in The Gaming Hut. So I've got three concepts for games in which the player characters are demons. And I'm going to hit you, Ken, with the three pitches. You're going to then pick which one of those you would like to flesh out with me for the remainder of The Gaming Hut.
Right.
So pitch number one is Highway from Hell. This is an insurgency game. It's an F20 style game in which you are devils and demons. We're going to decide later maybe how much we want to follow the traditional D&D world division between those two types of entities. But at any rate, you are looking to start a revolution in hell. Maybe you're good guy demons and devils the way that you are in the next pitch and might be in the last pitch. But your goal is you are attempting to overthrow the current lords of hell. And you're doing that in part, at least, as part of your insurgency. You are assisting mortal adventurers as they reave hell, as they come in to harrow the joint, and you are going to help use their epic powers in your quest to topple the rulers of hell. So that's the first one. Second one is Redeemed. This is an urban fantasy game set in the contemporary world where it turns out that there's somewhat of a loophole in the system, and that demons and devils, who are created entities, they aren't like, you know, evil souls who then grow horns and stuff and get to poke other, you know, lesser souls with pitchforks. They're created entities. Well, what happens if they have a moral epiphany and do a face turn? What if they turn good? Well, what happens is they get booted out of hell and land in the mortal world, where, of course, their demonic bosses hope that they slip and are tempted and then will wind up back in hell under their new sort of quasi-human life. And the thing is, they can disguise themselves as humans, but they can't entirely, as much as they want to hold on to the straight and narrow path, their demonic powers will sometimes flare up. And if they don't use them every so often, they will flare up inconveniently in a way that will cause trouble for them. So, of course, the player character who have these demonic powers, they try to use them for good. So it's an urban fantasy, maybe with a hint of supernatural superheroics about it, but they are trying to find reasons to go out and, without blowing their true identities, blow off steam, use their powers so that their powers don't use them. Finally, we have Rear Guard Defenders. This is the game in which the devils and demons realize that an alien force is coming to Earth. These alien beings, they do their research and they find that they've come to other worlds and they completely exterminate all mortal life on any planet. And that, of course, means that hell has no new souls to capture. It has no growth potential. It has nothing to do. Sometimes they suspect even that the damage done by the alien invaders is such that since there are physical doorways into hell, that hell is destroyed as well. And perhaps the aliens on other worlds have captured and exterminated all of the demons and devils from those worlds. So the demons realize that the upstairs is going to retain its usual non-interventionist approach. And if the Earth is going to be saved, they're going to have to send demons into the mortal world to prepare against this alien invasion, possibly look for a body snatcher, forward guard scouts, and get ready for the battle against the aliens. So Ken, which of those three would you like to develop more in the course of this segment?
Well, I like all of them, of course. I like the first one, but I'd like it better if you could use historically condemned humans as your guerrilla armies. So you're like, you know, helping Che Guevara rebel against hell or Francis Marion rebel against hell. Either of those, that'd be cool. It's less cool if it's just Kragar the Liberator and Umthrung the Fowler. You know, that's fine, but it's not as cool as if it was historical people. So I'm going to have to regretfully say no F-20 counterinsurgency, which sounds like the crunchiest crunch that ever crunched. The second option is the good version of Demon the Fallen, the old White Wolf demon game. It's the only one that would be worth playing in that setting, but I'm not vibing with it a ton just because both the interiority and the challenges seem like they would be relatively straightforward and eventually feel samey-samey, so it would be a short campaign at best. The third one, on the other hand, Demons versus Elliptony, well, that's got my name all over it. Let's do that one.
Okay. So the core activity then is you are undergoing missions to stave off an alien invasion. So I think one of the steps is to, and I think this would also obviously be a limited series because you're going to have the big confrontation in the
alien. Right. You're going to have to fight aliens at some point.
Yeah. You can only stretch that out so far. So what are the different player character types of these demons who've come to Earth to fight elliptonic aliens?
Well, I feel like with the player character types, you probably need like the demon who can, you know, you can scry in crystals and see stuff. He's not just your scout, but he's also the one that can, you know, tell, you know, where alien presence is likely or as some sort of, you know, a sensing apparatus. Your basic demon tank, so throws fire, is made of lava, etc., that guy, and keeping him under wraps is maybe a little sub-challenge that you have to do. Demonic magician who uses the powers of magic to sort of do your fill-in and maybe a little of your demon healing. I mean, it'd be fun if, as a demon, you can only heal at a place of great suffering, so you have to go to, like, a really badly run daycare center or something and heal up because you have to bleed off the excess evil in order to power up. That would be a fun challenge. And then the face, the tempter, the, hey, man, what can I do to put you in the driver's seat of a 7-year blank check and the love of the fair Marguerite? A soul? No, no, nothing so mundane, surely. And then, you know, that guy. I think that that's a fun character to play. It's a fun character in even outside demon fiction. The face is always a good delight. And then if we need a fifth one, if we can cordon off the mage from the sniper, from the long range effect demon, and that can either be that he has nano imps that fly out and do his bidding, or it can be that he's, you know, just got, you know, a bow from hell or a sniper rifle from hell or some kind of a long range, you know, magic wand that can affect stuff at a distance. And so he acts as the DPS guy when the tank is too far away or can't blow up into fireball because there's a good daycare center nearby.
For sure, you're going to have someone say, can I be the ninja? So your shadow demon takes that role. There's all sorts of infiltration and sneaking around that a shadow demon could get up to. Also, your sage character, your knowledge guy, who's the one who's the scribe down in hell, keeping all of the logs, keeping up the records of who's been naughty, who's been nice, less relevant. Mm-hmm. And so he could also be the one who understands human society, can explain it to the other demons. That can be a fun thing, right? That what is this vast structure that comes up from the world like Apollo? Well, this is what they call a skyscraper. And we have to, that could be some fun shtick there. And he could also be the one who's leading the face guy to the people that they need to draw in and get help from. So the first scenario is, I think, probably there's only the body snatcher wave has occurred. So your first thing is, you know, rooting out aliens who are disguised as humans, just as you're disguised as humans as well, and finding them and trying to understand their network and see what exactly they've infiltrated and how deep they are and what you're going to have to do to reverse that. Do we want to theme each scenario around a different classic type of sinister alien?
I guess, are the aliens the Alien Federation invading, or are they all one kind of alien, but the kind that has a bunch of different powers? So I think it can go either way. I might like the idea that the body snatchers and some of the others are sent out as scouts ahead of the main invasion, and the main invasion can be, you know, your standard bug-eyed monsters, but the rest are ones that can fit into humanity a little easier. And so those can be your body snatchers, they can be your vibrationally invisible aliens, they can be your Mego types that lurk in the hills and forests. So you can change it up with a bunch of different aliens while they all still serve, you know, the real classic green blobby guys with 9 arms that are coming.
Right. So you can have your next scenario can be the bug hunt in the woods. Mm-hmm. And there's possibly a bunch of different classic aliens with the serial numbers filed off that you could fight in that one. So I guess also there would be strategic places that you want to protect from alien influence. And so you could possibly get another scenario out of the body snatchers where you have to, you know, take over Area 51, which is the place where the humans have a little bit of knowledge of aliens and some anti-alien technology, but they've been infiltrated, or you know that the predators are coming to get them. And so it could be a installation mission where you're trying to get to and protect the crucial humans before the aliens get to them and slice them all up. So what's scenario 4?
Scenario 4 is, after you've gone to Area 51, you've noticed that some, as you say, some humans know about the alien threat, and maybe they know a little more than they're telling. And so, you know, the second in command of U.S. Space Command or some other powerful general seems to be not so much encouraging the aliens as he's got his own scheme for the aliens when they get there. And come to find out, of course, this being hell, you're working for Lucifer, but he has sold his soul to Asmodeus to get command of Space Command. And so there's a faction in hell that says, hold on, why are we stopping this invasion? Humans will do anything in wartime. We've proved that over and over and over. A war that covers the whole planet, lots of them are going to die in conditions of sin. First of all, we're going to have a huge influx. And then second of all, the survivors will get ever more desperate and animalistic and cruel. And so therefore, we should encourage the invasion. And that's Asmodeus's thought. Lucifer said, no, no, no. It ruins the flavor if they all come at once, or whatever Lucifer's reason is.
Yeah, you're not thinking long-term, Asmodeus. Right. That's always been your problem.
It's always been your problem. But again, you've got a guy, you've got the classic espionage story of the guy back at headquarters who's screwing your mission up. But in this case, well, I guess it's just as realistic as the CIA doing it, because it's hell doing it. And so the story might play out a little bit better. And then there's, if Asmodeus has his own team out, you can fight them in episode 6. Or Asmodeus is like, you know, nope. Lucifer agreed that the only people on Earth are you guys. I just have my standard quota of guys who are out there, you know, doing Asmodeus business. No new guys have come out. And then you have to figure out if Asmodeus is lying, or if the guys that Asmodeus had have all sort of subtly ticked over and are, instead of going after billionaires, they're going after astronomers and aviation specialists and people like that.
Then you could have a scenario revolving around a third force where you have to go in and do a mission, and then you're attacked by humans who welcome the end of the world. That's what they've been waiting for. This is the aliens. They realize, or according to their prophecy, are the mechanism that brings about the end of the world. And they're fine with that as long as they keep themselves pure. Well, you know how you keep yourself pure? By killing demons. And so you've got to either win over the ambitious second in command to take over this militant cult, and or, you know, you've just got to fight them off. They're in your way. If they get their way, the aliens will destroy the world. That's just as bad as the aliens who are destroying the world as far as you're concerned. So you've either got to suborn them or take them out. And so I guess this now brings us to the actual invasion beginning. And how many different scenarios can we spin that out into?
I think we can start with, depending on your group, either one of the player characters or a demon GMC that they've become friends with, or has been, you know, if their sage has not been a character, but has been the voice on the tape or the M, and they're abducted by aliens. And we have a classic alien abduction, except you've got to rescue him, because if they get that flying saucer back to the mothership and find out the demons are involved, then they'll just whomp up a whole bunch of demon killing weapons, because Earth's, you know, ace in the hole will be revealed. And so you have to go out and rescue them. Maybe that's capture another flying saucer and figure out how to use it and adventure that way, or whatever it is. But you've got to unabduct your demon cohort before they are taken up into the alien armada and your secret is out.
Then you could do a Top Gun, in which you, of course, as demons, can immediately figure out how fighter jets work, and you can bend them to your will. They're weapons of war, after all. They speak your language. And you can have a big dogfight against the advancing aliens and have a ship-to-ship small craft battle just straight out of the end of Star Wars as one of your big military engagements.
If you'd foreshadowed that with an AI adventure where the AI has become sentient but inhuman and is therefore deciding, am I a demon? Am I not a demon? What should I be doing? By the way, I've detected that there's alien invasion. What do I do about that? And if, you know, you had a sort of a persuasion type adventure, because killing an AI is hard even for a demon, then the AI is who helps you take over the F-35, of course, which is all computer flown anyway. So that is, you know, your callback to an earlier adventure lets you fly the F-35 far beyond its rated capacity, or its officially rated capacity. Does the Space Command know more than it's telling even now? And go Top Gun on these aliens.
And then finally, whatever number of players there are, that you have your 5 or 6 horsemen scenario, in which you have your big giant land battle against the tripods and the mechanical leviathans and the cyborg dinosaurs, and you pull out the big battle tropes from your favorite war movies and have a big climactic finish where it's not necessarily certain whether you're going to repel the aliens. But if you do, there's all sorts of questions about what that means to the world now that you've, you know, initially you were hiding what you were doing, but at the end it became pretty apparent who was leading the battle against the aliens. And perhaps that suggests a sequel in which the demons have outed themselves, and what that means for the survivors and for geopolitics in a post-alien invasion world is, I guess, the sequel game that you publish after this one.
And I like the idea of you mentioned the horsemen. I like the idea that in addition to your other third forces, you've got, whatever is going on in Space Command. You've got, you know, the Chinese, because they've been doing their own anti-alien stuff that we don't even know about, or have they? Question mark. And then we've got the actual horseman of war, who's like, great, saddle up. It's the end times. I've got to go. And you have to sort of either redirect him so that he does the most damage to the aliens, or talk him down and say, no, no, this isn't the end times. This is just an alien invasion. Check it out. And whether it's the face or the tank that goes after the horseman of war, that could be a fun decision that you have to make, because if he gets to, you know, Washington, D.C., then the nukes launch and then everything goes to hell, literally, and not in the way you want. So fun happens then.
Well, I think having sketched out a full campaign for the Demons versus Aliens game, we can close up this segment. But since this is episode 666, we have another devil or demon topic waiting for you on the other side of this here commercial. ...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase.
The devil moving geographical things around. The devil being tricked by clever people. And the devil just being devilish tell us that we're in a particularly demonic installment of the Mythology Hut. And this time around, it seems to me the obvious question, given that this is episode 666, is why 666? Why is it such a big deal? Where did it come about? And what are the various meanings that have attached to it? And Ken, you have gone a-delving.
Yep. 666 comes from the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, last book of the Bible, specifically from Revelation chapter 13, verses 11 to 18. And this is the second beast, which comes after the dragon. And we're not talking about the dragon. The dragon has got his wound and then recovered from his wound. This is the second beast. This is the King James Version, accept no substitutes. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon, and he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save that he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666.
Now, figuring out what the heck is up in the book of Revelations is, the further you get away from it in history, the more confusing it becomes, because it was originally written as a, or many scholars believe it was originally written as a coded political allegory directed against the Roman administration that was persecuting Christians and had to be so written in order to, once, you know, you got confronted for writing this book or providing to other people, it's completely unclear exactly what's going on. And of course, there are many periods in history that are friendly to allegory. Now, in later centuries, one person's allegory is another person's source of weird prophecy. Revelations is by many measures the weirdest book in the New Testament. And
there is one very strong and perhaps even still reputable school of belief that says that it was basically a hallucinogenic trip, because the island of Patmos, where St. John composed the book, is full of hallucinatory mushrooms, hallucinogenic mushrooms. So pretty exciting if you get a divinely inspired drug trip. It's lets you sort of feel better about all the hippies for a bit.
Right. And then you stop. It's certainly featured in many hallucinations since it was written,
right,
either from people who are on mushrooms or who are suffering from schizophrenia. But there is a logical meaning behind all of this, including the logical explanation for why 666.
Yeah. The number in the manuscripts of the book of Revelation is given in Greek numerals, chi, psi, sigma, not spelled out. And so it doesn't say 600, 666 in Greek. It just says the numbers. And we should at this point take a note that Papyrus 115, which is around 250 AD, which is the oldest manuscript of the book of Revelation, gives the number as 616 iota instead of xi, as do several other third and fourth century sources. But Irenaeus, in his Against Heresies in 180 AD, said that it was 666, not 616, and everyone should get their copies straightened out. And his authority for this is people who asked St. John which it was, and he said it was 666. So there you go. So anyway, the reason that that matters is that the number has a value in words. It is what we recognize now as gematria, the sort of one of the cores of Kabbalism, the notion that you add up the values of the letters, each letter being also a numeral, and you get the secret meaning of that word. And so in Greek, by the way, that's isopsephi or isosephi. And the word count in the original Revelation is sephisato, which means to reckon or to figure up, not to count in the sense of just counting sheep. This is to do some calculation. So that is why it is plausible that it is gematria. So 666 is the number of Neron Caesar in the Hebrew gematria. Neron is Greek for Nero. And one of the possible explanations is if you drop off the N to get Nero Caesar, then you do it through Greek gematria, then you get 616. And so there's the arguments about should we do it in Hebrew or should we do it in Greek, I think, are your edition wars of the book of Revelation.
Right. And as in all numerology, people do what they need to do to get to the result they need.
Right. But in this case, the result seems to have been baked in, because obviously a esoteric, perhaps mushroom-friendly prophet is going to know gematria. That is a sacred art that has been known and practiced in the Middle East since the 7th or 6th century BC. It's definitely part of the mystic Jewish tradition that Christianity comes out of. So there's no stretch in saying that John of Patmos put this in on purpose. Whether or not he meant Nero is the question, but since Nero fits the numbers, he probably did.
Yeah, he put in a number. That's,
right.
He must have been thinking about something, even right, if he
exactly.
was tripping on psilocybin.
Right. And Nero is allegedly the emperor who exiled John to the island of Patmos in the first place. So that would make sense if he's got a special mad on for Nero. Also, of course, Nero is the first great persecutor of the Christians. And so that sort of focuses the mind on him as the ultimate bad guy. And that is the sort of favorite theory of what is called the Preterite school, which believes that the book of Revelation is written either in the reign of Nero or shortly thereafter, around 70 AD, when the Romans capture Jerusalem and destroy the second temple. And that is the abomination of desolation that is prophesied by Jesus, and that it is in that context that John is either doing shrooms or getting righteously mad and writing about how all of this is going to be destroyed. And Jesus is going to come back with a sharp sword and slaughter everyone who looked at everyone funny.
So the other school of thought about the composition of the Book of Revelation is that it was written much later, around 100 AD, give or take, and that would be during the reign of Domitian. And it turns out that there is a non-Christian legend in that it appears in Suetonius that Nero had either faked his death in 68 and gone to hide in the Greek East and would lead the Greek East against bad old Rome. So it's a revolutionary apocalyptic theory in the Greek East. Again, guess where Patmos is? On the basis that Nero liked to pretend he was Greek instead of Roman. Or that he was going to somehow rise again from the dead. Again, not the only guy in the Middle East who is reputed to have risen again from the dead. And this was the myth of Nero Redivivus. And sure enough, we see exactly that happen. The fake Nero, who says, I'm Nero risen from the dead, or miraculously kept young, I'm not sure which, appeared during the reign of Domitian. And Domitian, of course, is also a gigantic persecutor of Christians. And since conventional non-preterite scholarship says John is writing Revelation during the reign of Domitian, Nero is just code for Domitian, because Nero rising is the beast that's going to come out of the ocean and end everything.
Right. He's become a synecdoche. He's a representative of all other measly emperors who would persecute people. They're all just chips off the Neronian block.
So either Nero refers to the actual Nero Redivivus as the second beast, or it's referring to Domitian because he is just a knockoff of Nero, basically, which is a heck of a diss on Domitian, frankly, which I guess is why you have to keep it in code and not point it out when people ask you, even if you're Saint Irenaeus.
So this number then goes down into history and is adopted by anyone who wants to pretend to wield the powers of darkness or of Satan. So how does that number reverberate through later occultism?
You see it, it's most often in the Middle Ages and then the Enlightenment, it's applied to your enemies. So they went to a great deal of effort in the Middle Ages to figure out how Muhammad could add up to be 666. And they got to Muametis, and then they had to bring in phony Byzantine chronicles and change them in manuscript to change Muhammad's name to Muametis so they could point back and say, look, he was 666 all along. In the Reformation, Martin Luther figured out that the name of the current Pope was 666. Plenty of Jesuits then counter figured out that Martin Luther or John Calvin were 666. And once it stops being a club to literally set your opponents on fire with, it becomes, as you say, a sort of an edgelord thing. And the most famous edgelord of all, Aleister Crowley, named himself Tomegatherion, the great beast. And the is important to make his number add up to 666. So where a lesser occultist might have just said 626, I guess, he puts in the work, puts in the, and that's the way he gets it. And then, of course, the number is kept alive in various apocalyptic screeds. I, in fact, have a very strong memory of my dad working campaign phones for Ronald Reagan, and someone called up and they said, as a concerned Christian, how does Ronald Reagan spell his middle name? And of course, Ronald Wilson Reagan would be 666, six letters. And my dad said, Wilson, of course. And that is how you answer phones in, you know, 1980 anyway. So that was great fun, but it was still obviously on people's mind. Even now, you have runners or athletes from Christian schools or who are just raised right, who are given the, you know, number 666 in a tournament. They forfeit out of the tournament rather than bear that number. Reagan himself famously had his address changed in Santa Barbara to 664 so that he would not have the number of the beast as his address.
Yeah, 664 is the number of the president.
That's the neighbor of the beast, exactly. Yeah. And one of the sort of back formations, people who don't believe that John meant anything, say that because 888 is the number of Jesus, they figured out that 666 must be the number of the Antichrist, and that therefore that's where it goes. And then later people applied it to Nero with sort of the same sort of clever back projection that people applied it to the Pope or whoever else. But I think that the odds are pretty good that John of Patmos knew a little gematria and figured it out while he was there on his island killing time.
So in any later period of history where you have a historical game, people throwing that number around are doing so for a combination of political and spiritual reasons, and that can tell you a lot about them. But You want to make sure that they don't have powers of some kind, because if they put that number on you, then you've got to get that number off. And maybe, you know, as we saw in the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, put it back on them.
Right. Now, of course, the number of the beast is just the generic notion that you have to have a number attached to you to buy or sell. You have to have your, you know, your bank account, your RFID number, your whatever the number is that you're panicking about. And I guess that is one way to take the meaning of the Antichrist. But I feel like the Antichrist has got other clearer examples of his power than making you type in double factor authentication every time.
Yes. Back in the olden days of conspiracy, the introduction of barcodes was thought by some to introduce the number that you could needed to buy or sell different things. And certainly making us get a 6-digit number to type in all the time. I'm sure we can think of present day conspirators who every time they have to open up their 2-factor authorization are wondering what exactly is happening to them and who's doing this to them. And can they go live on a farm somewhere where they don't have to do this anymore?
And even then, that sort of echoes. Some people think that because Nero put his name on all the money very eagerly, in fact, that he was just referring to, well, of course you have to have the name and face and number of the beast because he's on the money. And that's how you deal with the Roman Empire, is with Roman money. And that it's not a cryptic explanation at all, any more than if you were prophesying against George Washington, you'd say, look, his face is on the money. You can't live without George Washington staring up at you.
And money is bad.
Right.
That's a common theme.
Or at least money with filthy Romans touching it is bad.
Exactly. Well, one form of money is good, and that's the money that keeps this podcast alive by having advertising. So let's sample a beautiful, entirely non-demonic ad and then come back for another segment. In the spiral.
4 scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Stop our numbers from turning beastly by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Derek McMullen,
Michael Hawkins,
John W.S. Marvin,
Will Ferguson and Fifi Pyatt,
and Ruth Tillman.
The footprints in the forest. The screams in the night, the splatter of blood on the cave wall, and the cool entry in a bestiary or monster manual welcome us into the Monster Hut. And today we are going outside the Judeo-Christian West for a demon of a different ilk, although maybe there is a bit of overlap, as we will see, but the Sasa Bonsam begins as a demon of the Akan people, who are the folks who lived on the coast of Africa in what is now Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and Togo. And they include, but are not restricted to, the Ashanti, if you're curious as to are they the same guys. And they are some of the same guys. Not all Akan are Ashanti, but all Ashanti turn out to be Akan. You may also know the Sasabonsam as the Asanbosam, the Asasabonsam, the Samatam, the Shamantin, and the Susabonsam. And I don't know if this is sloppy European transcriptions or just Akan having a lot of different languages and dialects, and you get different names for the same being, but the being is definitely a West African demonic monster. And now, thanks to the slave trade, he is also a Jamaican monster, because even as early as 1774, people were reporting that the folk in Jamaica believed in the Asanbosam or the Sasabonsam. And so, Robin, why did you pick this wonderful creature and tell us about him?
So I thought, as you noted, it would be good to get a non-European demon in there. And he starts his career as a spirit or monster, whether he's exactly a demon at the beginning, we don't know, but he becomes a demon later as members of different Akan cultures Christianize. So he definitely gets folded into that and becomes more conventionally demonic as the legend spreads. And like all great legends, there's all kinds of different variations. But the core of this is that he lurks in the forest. Of course, pre-modern cultures almost always regard the forest as a place of danger because, spoiler, it is. And the Sasabonsam favors a couple of trees, including the cotton tree. So you kind of at least know which trees to look for and avoid if you're looking not to get attacked by it. But he's basically a personification of the danger of the forest. So just entering the forest opens you up to attack, especially if you're entering the forest and breaking a taboo. So, for example, if it's a sacred day when you're told not to go into the forest, well, who's going to enforce that? Well, of course, it's the Sasabonsam. And you're going to get yourself attacked, particularly Thursdays turn out to be a day not to go in. So you want to avoid that. And why do you want to avoid that? Well, because he's extremely terrifying. There's a bunch of different descriptions of him. There's one in which he has iron teeth, glowing red eyes. He hangs in the tree by a couple of different methods, depending on who you're talking to. Sometimes he's got great hooked feet to hang down, or other times he has a prehensile tail with a snake head on the end of it. And so, of course, snakes in forests are especially scary, and snakes attached to a demonic monster even more so. So whether he's hanging from the tree by his claws or from his snaky tail, he can bite you in the neck and drink your blood. Oh, guess what? He's not just an evil spirit. He's not just a demon, but he's a vampire.
Yep. Couldn't love him more. There are a number of monsters that are in any thickly forested area that amount to the monster that lives in the tree and drops down and eats you. The Ngojama in Kenya is maybe the most famous, but there's a lot of them. The Chemezit.
Also the jaguar.
The jaguar, yes, that legendary yeah. beast. And so the Sasabonsam is the Akan version of this guy. And sometimes, if he's hanging by his cool snake tail, he will use his big hook feet to hook you like a slab of meat and pull you up into the branches, where he will bite off your head, which is what he has in common with a number of horrible flying monsters. So
yeah, no subtle fanging you in the neck. He's a head biter.
And then drinks your foaming blood as it spurts out of your neck.
He may have long red hair, long black hair. Sometimes he's described as having a vaguely bat-like head. Others' descriptions are just the head of an animal, not too specific there. But one account gives him a flaming mouth, as if he did not have enough attacks. Clearly, this is a boss monster. And a long tongue, which sticks out most of the time. Probably, I would think, you know, licking up the spare bits of blood that spattered all over him when he ripped your head off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a bit in there where you see descriptions of him as having pink skin, which I think is a little, what's the scariest thing in the forest? Europeans, everybody. But he is often also described as having black and white spotted skin, which is a different than pink. And I guess, you know, unless you're being attacked by firemen and they've brought their Dalmatians, that's probably closer to the OG Sasabonsam color scheme, though he may still have the long red or black hair.
Now, I'm going to kind of speculate that as the descriptions of him become more recent that European demon characteristics get folded onto him. So
yeah,
there are other versions of him where instead of having the cool clawed, grab you, haul you up into the trees talons, he has hooves. So I think we know what has happened there. And Ken, you've also discovered that just staying out of the forest is not enough. If everybody stays out of the forest, well, the Sasabonsam is going to come to you.
Right. But he will at least not probably bite your head off. He sneaks into the village and drinks blood from a sleeper's thumb. So you go to sleep, your thumb's outside your cot or your mat, and sure enough, the Sasabonsam is there to drink it up. I assume maybe he does that through his snake tail mouth, not from his regular horrendous mouth, because surely he's not got such delicate little iron teeth that he can only drink a little bit of blood from your thumb. I assume that you'd pull back a bloody stump if that happened.
Right. So presumably he's bound by the rules. He has to taboo breakers get their heads ripped off. But everybody else, if he's thirsty, he has to go in and be stealthy and just take a little bit of blood because the rules apply to him.
Exactly. I mean, he's the rule guy. They would have to apply to him. By 1897, we have a ethnologist named Mary Kingsley, who, by the way, sounds great, like a real trip of a person. But she goes into the Akan country and she reports that the Sasabonsam tree, you can always tell it because it's surrounded by red soil or red earth. And this, of course, is from the constant bloodening. And she says that the Akan, in classic fashion, say that other tribes will sacrifice humans to those trees. We, of course, merely sacrifice goats. And that keeps the Sasabonsam happy in his tree, and he doesn't come drink our thumb blood or attack us if we're in the forest, not on a Thursday, but doing our forest business, you know, collecting wood or whatever else, getting fruit. That kind of thing.
Right. Another element that makes the Sasabonsam fit in the demon category is that he traffics with humans and gives them magical powers. So witches, Abayifo, if they're female, Bonsam, if male, it's right in his name, Sasabonsam, can make a magic fetish, can by carving a figure out of a root or branch, and they daub it with blood, red earth, previously mentioned, and rum, and squeeze on juice from different leaves. And Ken, how does the fetish let you know that it's full of Sasabonsam power?
The fetish, by the way, is called the Sutman, which is great. I love the fact that it has its own cool name. And if you've done everything right, it will hiss when you squeeze the juice on it. And that lets you know a Sasabonsam has entered your Sutman, and you can do magic with your Sutman, and that you can curse people, you can stop fires, you can, I assume, you know, find treasure under special trees. You've got your own sort of demon on your hip, and I assume that makes you kind of a terrifying and baller figure near a local area. So
right. Hence the Akan saying, when a Sasabonsam attends a funeral, it lodges with the Abayifo, which means there's the standard concern of sorcerers who are drawing on the power of demons or evil spirits and can cause all sorts of trouble, but live among you. And of course, that's not a universal, but a widespread belief that crosses a lot of cultural boundaries. Now, the Sasabonsam is the weird creature that we're focusing on, but it's not the only one that the Akan can find in the forest. There's also the Mimosha, which is another dangerous, perhaps not quite so sinister being, but they're not your friends. But they have a lot of herbal knowledge, so sometimes you have to go and talk to them about plants. And in some accounts, they're described as being dwarf-like.
So just remember, if you're looking down, then that's a Muatia. If you're suddenly have your head chopped off by an iron claw, that was a Sasabonsam, and you shouldn't have done that.
Right. Now, the other interesting cool thing about this is that this folkloric figure turns into a cryptid.
Yeah.
And there have been sightings.
Yeah, the only recorded sighting of a Sasabonsam as such occurred allegedly in 1918 when a British official, L.W. Wood, was reported to have taken a picture of a dead Sasabonsam. But when the guy who was collecting the legend in 1939 asked him, "So tell me about you taking a picture of the dead Sasabonsam," his informant had said it was 1928, and Wood said, "I wasn't even in the Ashanti country in 1928. I was there in 1918, and I have no recollection of taking a picture of a Sasabonsam. Leave my office, sir."
Just what the Ordo Veritatis told him to say.
Exactly. But the witness who saw the British guy take their Sasabonsam corpse
described it as having black and white skin, 20-foot-long bat wings, which is amazing, a bearded face this time, and a ridged chest that stuck out like a chicken, so a big keel bone in his chest. And we are now getting into the point where people are carving Sasa Bansam images, and they're either using them to give local chiefs, you know, indicating that they're lords of the forest, or to give to curious British ethnologists in exchange for money. And by 1935, the Sasa Bansam that's in the British Museum, he's got devil horns, he's got a regular face, he's got bat-like wings, he doesn't have his long, cool claws. He just basically looks like a tiny little, you know, Assyrian-style devil, like a little Pazuzu guy.
Right. Well, maybe the claws are just sort of holding on to the staff.
Right. Yeah, let's say that.
Hold out hope. Yeah.
But he's a wood carving, so we won't know where his iron claws and or teeth are anyway. So there we are. Some people associate the Sasa Bansam as a cryptid, and they say, well, he's got these wings, he's got a keel. Maybe they're actually mean the Kongamato, the breaker of boats, which is a kind of a reddish-colored pterosaur that digs up corpses and eats them, which is, I guess, where they get the Sasa Bansam connection. And he was seen in 1923 in western Zambia, western Upper Rhodesia, as it was then. And that's, like, across the continent from the Akan territory. So I don't personally buy any connection between the Kongamato. I think the Kongamato is his own dude, and there's lots and lots of sightings of the Kongamato, and I think people are just mad that there's just that one Sasa Bansam sighting just sitting there ruining it for everyone.
They're trying to merge two separately awesome entities.
Exactly.
Only one of which is a Pelgrane.
And only one of which is a vampire. So there.
Right. So if you want to gamify the Sasa Bansam, don't rely on us. There are already 5e stats for us. They appear in the book African Monsters from Legendary Games. Although I would be tempted to add some more attacks based on the different descriptions of the... If you have the JSTOR description, he has a snake head, and I would like to see that in right. Monster stats, or at least in a variant.
Well, we'll make Rob do him in 13th age so that all of his various attacks can come up on different die rolls.
Yeah, so if he gets a 16 or higher, the snake head comes
right. out. And on a 20, he can lap you with his fiery mouth.
Yeah. And he rips your head off, and then you say, wait a minute, I didn't get a saving throw against that. And then
you never do.
Sheepish and let you have your head back. Well, we're going to keep our heads on our shoulders through this exciting commercial, but we'll be back on the other side for another exciting segment. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. We're going to stop on the landing and wave to the King of the Fire Salamanders. He's going to give us an elemental wink because that's just the kind of supernatural amphibian he is. And then we're going to head on into the parlor of the Edwardian occultist where, in the spirit of episode 666, we're going to ask about a demonologist and someone who is responsible for perhaps one of the funnest, most gameable books of demon cataloging, but also a whole bunch of other books, because he was sort of the 18th and 19th century equivalent of, I guess, someone like Colin Wilson, who was very prolific, wrote a bunch of stuff, not just paranormal stuff. And his name is Jacques Collin de Plancy. He didn't start out with exactly that name, though, did he?
No, he did not. He started out in 1793 as Jacques Adam Simon Collin, and he was born in Plancy, which is where the de Plancy would eventually come from. Plancy is near Troyes in Champagne. Right around the time he was born, it became the Department of Aube. But he was a nephew of Danton, which is pretty great. One imagines.
Although he never met him because Danton died when he was
right.
One.
Yeah. He just probably, you know, had lots of Danton books and said, why can't you be cool like your uncle? But he did, in the tradition of Danton, he became a Voltairean style free thinker and then became a printer and publisher, which I guess is the tradition of Marat more. But anyway, once he becomes a publisher, he needs to get clientele. So he adds De Plancy to his name, pretending to be an aristocrat. This is, of course, after the war, when pretending to be an aristocrat is once more cool. And in 1818, as maybe not the first thing that he published, but pretty early in his career, he publishes the first version of his Dictionnaire Infernal, which at that time was either in 3 or 2 volumes. I think you could pick which one you got it, because the reprint was just the 3-volume version of the 2-volume, because the 2 volumes would be very thick. And it was just a compendium, not just of demons, but also of magic, of superstition, of cool stuff that he thought about, of monsters. It was very much a, hey, future game masters of the world, you'll need this.
It looks a lot like a early 19th century monster manual. It's in alphabetical order. It's got descriptions of a whole bunch of different demon lords, which I think have still not even been fully plundered for game mastering purposes, because
there are too much good in there. Yeah. And in fairness, because so many of them are not immediately story centric, like this demon will sit and tell you about the history of Germany. And it's like, okay, I get that. But then after I've been punished for my sins, what happens? So in 1819, he publishes the Feudal Dictionary, which is probably a look at all the atrocities that feudal people, the old aristocracy committed. Ignore the fact that I'm pretending to be De Plancy, and a autobiography of the devil, which also is sort of a bunch of creepy stories and devil stories called The Devil Painted by Himself. And that was also very popular.
Right. So we're creeping into the world of Gothic fiction. And there's a great illustration from a later edition, an 1825 edition, that has a picture of him lounging in bed in his sleeping togs, while the very sort of charming, animated-looking devil sits there and discourses to him. So I guess this is an early version of the As Told To biography.
Yeah, the next thing that pops up on our, and because I'm obviously skipping over a lot of the other stuff, I'm not
even. You said prolific.
Right. I'm not even sure we have a complete list of De Plancy's output. But in 1820, he does The History of Vampires and Evil Specters, which I have to admit I am tempted to buy. There is a company called Abracax House that does editions of De Plancy books in English and, you know, in nice sort of pseudo leatherette format, and they look cool. And the Vampires and Evil Ghosts one is one of those that's available. And
I know an upcoming book by you that would inform.
Yeah. So anyway, 1821, he does the Critical Dictionary of Relics and Miraculous Images. This is another 3-volume tome. And again, this is, ha-ha, aren't relics and images funny? Look at the Catholics. Look at them dance. Look at them dance! But in 1821, he also writes a novel called The Voyage to the Center of the Earth, in which everyone goes to the center of the earth, and it turns out it's a Voltaire-style utopia, and they're very bored there. And so they return to the surface. And that's the story.
And this is why the Jules Verne version is the one we remember.
Exactly.
Journey to the center of boredom.
Journey to the center of, I guess. Journey to the center of ennui. And in 1826, he writes Notes on the Jesuits, which is more, you know, look at all the bad things Jesuits have done. In 1830, during the 1830 revolution in France, he moves to Belgium, which maybe implies that he's a little more De Plancy than he is Danton by then. And while in Belgium, he converts to Catholicism and becomes a eager Catholic convert, just as much as he was an eager making fun of Catholics freethinker. He pivots to publishing history texts.
Right. And, you know, the iconoclast to religious conservative horseshoe is one that has existed before then, exists now.
Right.
If you spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff, you may well make that horseshoe turn.
Precisely. There is a clash, an apposite clash lyric that we could quote, except we don't want to lose our family-friendly site. Anyway, while in Belgium, he publishes the no doubt Belgian bestseller, Military Record of the Belgians. That's in 1836. 1844, he has a 3rd edition of the Dictionnaire Infernal. It's still a bestseller. So he revises it and gets the church imprimatur. He gets his local priest to sign off on it. And so if you want the, you know, the real black metal version, that's the 1818. But the 1844, I think, tones it down, but then it adds lots of other cool stuff, because once you've got a priest talking about demons, you have another source.
Right, because the Catholic Church thinks demons are bad and scary and right, so that doesn't change your mission too much, really.
And they have thousands of years of records of them. In 1846, he actually co-writes the Dictionary of Occult Sciences with Father Jacques-Paul Migne. In 1853, his son Victor Colin de Plancy, is born. He grows up to be the French ambassador to Korea in 1884 after a brief investigation of his last name, when they discover, hey, your last name is made up. What's going on here?
Yeah, that doesn't turn out to be good for him. But he still has a measure of fame today, because the books and art that he collected in Korea became the cornerstones of different collections in Paris, including the Bibliothèque Nationale. So he was the first person to bring Korean art to France.
And he returns from Korea. 1894 is his last year in Korea. So if you're running your Yellow King game and you want to know about these demons and devils that keep popping up, maybe the son of Colin de Plancy is the guy you get to talk to. 1861, by the way, a new kid in the house, new kid to feed. Back to the bestsellers, back to the hits, Infernal Legends. In 1862, Legends of the Other World, of Heaven, Purgatory, and Hell. In 1863, he comes up with the absolute killer marketing idea of republishing by now a sixth edition of the Dictionnaire Infernal. But not only are there new subject matter, not only is there new priest stuff in, but also he gets a gifted artist named Louis Le Breton, who mostly painted seascapes and was an otherwise ineffectual minor dude, but
from the magical land of Brittany, so had something in his blood to make these super cool illustrations.
And apparently was waiting his whole life to be told, draw demons, because his demons are amazing. I mean, some of them are legit scary, like the owl with fangs. Don't like that guy, Ammon. That's a bad demon. But a lot of them just look like bored Parisians with, you know, goats sticking out of them, that kind of thing. So it's lovely, wonderful illustrations. And that, of course, blew the Dictionnaire Infernal up to a gigantic bestseller. You know, couldn't keep it in print. And that is the edition that the good people at Abracax House have translated. And that's the edition that I have, with those lovely, lovely illustrations.
Right. And you have probably seen these illustrations without necessarily knowing that they were Louis Le Breton or that they come from the Dictionnaire Infernal.
Not least because MacGregor Mathers ripped them off for his own copy of the Legend of Breton. So there we are.
Public domain art.
Except I don't think it was, but whatever. 1871.
It is after a magical sorcerer turns it public domain.
He does a book of end of time prophecies. In 1878, he's, I guess, in retirement. Maybe he's, you know, going back to the old homestead. And he does just a little 44-page book, The Catalog of Reptiles and Batrachians of Ob. He goes back home, and he's like, there's a lot of snakes and frogs around. Does anyone notice this? No, just you, Mr. Devil's Dictionary guy. So he does a little catalog. And then in 1881, he dies in Paris. His son, as we mentioned, carries on the family name, as problematic as that proves to be. And that is the story of Colin de Plancy, a publisher and therefore evil, but a publisher of books about demons and therefore cool.
Right. Well, if you own the printing press, you can approve your own work, which saves a lot of time. You can spend more time cataloging demons and Batrachians. So, like we said, the gameability of this is yet to be fully plumbed. Like we said, there's a big chunk of it that just look like a monster manual. And I'm sure with effort, even the demon who talks to you about German history and presumably the Reinheitsgebot can be made into a source of terror. So that was episode 666. We'll be back with a differently numbered, entirely innocent episode. In fact, next week will be our live episode that you recorded with Darcy at Gen Con. I'll be off at the Robin and Valerie International Film Festival at the time when we would have otherwise been recording, but we'll be back a mere week from now with a very exciting, fun episode. Steph, having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games,
Dark Tower,
and Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from iron-toothed tree demons by joining such backers as
Sean Stevenson,
Steve Siggity,
Tom Abella,
Bill Sirwan,
and the Redacted Files Podcast.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Three Eye Atlas. It's a really fun space rock.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.